All right, good morning. It is nice to see all of you here today. Port Washington High School has come to visit us this time around. We were just over there to visit you and enjoyed it a great deal. What an amazing old courthouse to be in. So thank you for that. That was a real treat being over there. Would you please stand up so we can acknowledge you? Super. Nice having you here today. It's my understanding that you won't be able to stay for Justice Krofsky's presentation. You're welcome to. If something changes, then you can, but you're really going to miss out. No, I'm kidding you. It'll be just fine. You're gonna survive without being there for the presentation. Sometimes people can. Sometimes they can't, and it's all good either way. But nice to have you here today. All right. Go ahead and have a seat. Now for State versus Avin Rondell Nimmer, 20 AP 878 CR. Appearances, please. Okay, good morning to both of you. The lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, and a remaining 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, Ms. Bice, we will hear from you first.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the Court. Milwaukee police officers use a gunshot detecting system that sends alerts to officers when it's sent gunfire. The alerts give them a location, an address, and tell them how many shots were fired. Officers who are in the area can sometimes arrive at that spot within a minute of getting the alert, and that's what happened in this case. But there's no published case in Wisconsin that gives guidance for the kind of investigatory stops officers can do once they arrive. So in this case, when the Court of Appeals, in the state's view, got the reasonable suspicion totality of the circumstances analysis quite wrong, the state petitioned for review. The state asked this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and do a proper totality of the circumstances analysis, giving meaning to the factual findings and credibility determinations the circuit court made, because they are supported by the record and not clearly erroneous.
I'm looking at the circuit court decision on page 36, and the judge in that case said, really, anyone that they encountered within a minute or two of receiving the alert should have been investigated if they were within a couple of blocks of the alleged shots being fired. That is what they did here. So is it your position that all you need to do is live or work or be walking in an area where shots are fired, and then, well, according to ShotSpotter, and you would be subject to search?
I'm glad you brought that up right away because that's the first thing I wanted to address. That is not the state's position. I think that the state's briefing distanced itself a bit and said that was a stray comment. If it was not a stray comment, that's not the state's position in this case. I think that runs afoul of the some quantum of individualized suspicion aspect of the reasonable test.
So you need something more than ShotSpotter?
Something more than ShotSpotter.
Okay, do you need something more? What if there was ShotSpotter and more than one person in the area? Or I guess I should ask it this way. How much weight does the state put on the fact that this individual was the only one that was seen at the time the officers arrived?
The state thinks that weighs pretty heavily in this case, that there is the timing, that this is putting officers there within a minute of receiving the alert of the shots fired, and in addition to that, his conduct when he saw officers.
Can I ask you about the timing issue? According to the record, it says that it was a minute. Right, and I'm assuming that if the police officers are responding to a shooting, that they're approaching with their lights and sirens, and that's not in the record, but I think that's a pretty safe assumption. I have a hard time believing that. It doesn't seem, let me put it this way, it seems illogical to me that if someone shot a gun at a person or at something, and for a full 60 seconds heard the sirens coming, that they would stay in the area. Like, I don't understand why that makes your argument stronger.
I don't believe that this, as you said, that the record indicates that sirens were on. I know in other cases that I have read, that has been a part of the questioning, and in other cases I have seen it that they did not turn on lights and sirens when they're in an area and they get the shots fired. So I don't know what the fact is in this case, so I can't. I understand your question. Why would somebody still be there a minute later?
Let me ask you a different question then regarding along those same lines. Why are we assuming that if someone's outside, they committed a crime? Well, why wouldn't they go inside? And you're saying that as long as someone is outside in the area, what about all the people who are inside in that area?
Is the
I just don't understand.
In
why,
other words, why doesn't my argument get officers inside the houses of people?
No, why? Tell me why we should be putting weight on the fact that he was outside. Presumably, if someone committed a crime, they might immediately go inside.
Well, I've learned that in my work at the AG's office, even as a fairly new person, that people don't do what is smart, even if they're criminals. So that gives a little more credit, maybe, than many people deserve.
It's part of the record. I'm just curious if.
Well, I think the argument. Maybe I'm not understanding the argument, but I thought what the state's argument was that there's reasonable suspicion for a number of reasons. That they have the shot spotter. That Mr. Nimmer was outside in the area, and then that he walked away from police quickly. So I guess my question goes to, he's outside in that area. Why is that? How does that get the police to reasonable suspicion?
I think that it might help if I don't think in the area gets us there. I mean, the fact that that a person may be blocks away from a shots fired with nothing more, you know, in the area is too vague, and that's not the state's position, that anybody in the area. But the idea is when the officers get an address, they happen to be nearby, and within a minute, the officer testified that he was almost exactly, I mean, he was at that block, maybe 80 feet from where the address was that the shot spotter alert came. He was the only person in that intersection. And I think this gets back to the reasonable suspicion standard, which is low. It is more than just a hunch, and it requires specific articulable facts and some quantum of individualized suspicion, which I think is a little bit, I'm not trying to undermine that. It does require some quantum of individualized suspicion. And the state, of course, doesn't always win these suppression motions.
So let's talk about the facts here. Shot spotter reports 4 gunshots in an address that's a few blocks away from the officer's location.
Correct. Yes.
And the officer responds. He's a 9-year veteran, responded to at least 1,000 shot spotter alerts, is trained as a police officer in the violent crime saturation unit. That training involves him knowing what to look for when he arrives on a scene. First thing he looks for is whether someone is injured and needs medical attention. Then turns to, are there witnesses who might offer some information about what transpired? He looks for people who act nervously or might be trying to escape, avoid police, or hide something. So he arrives at the scene. He sees one and only one person, the defendant in this case, walking westbound, and speeds up as he notices the officer's vehicle, increases the pace, accelerates his walk. The officer approaches him. He digs his left hand into the waistband, turns his left hip, blading away from the officer, and they proceed accordingly to question him. Are those the facts of this case?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear.
And it's those, the Court of Appeals opinion in this case was problematic for various reasons. Most specifically, it sort of did took the investigation, the stop, completely out of the context of a shots fired investigation, and the fact that Nimmer was found, the testifying officer said, exactly at the spot, almost exactly at the spot where the shots were fired. Why he didn't run further or faster, I don't know, but those questions don't negate the articulable facts that do exist for reasonable suspicion. The problem with the court of
counsel, when you say and made the comment that you don't know why he stayed or didn't run faster, indicates to me a suggestion that he fired the gun. He was the source of the shot. And there's nothing in the record to indicate that, is there?
I would respectfully...
Respond
that the court, the circuit court said this doesn't affect the reasonable suspicion, but the police officers did recover a cartridge that matched the gun that they recovered from Nimmer. That is in the record. A spent cartridge that matched, it was a .40 caliber.
Okay.
But the circuit court said, that doesn't affect my reasonable suspicion analysis, which we, of course, know anything you find afterwards, doesn't, you know, say, aha, there it was. But so I'm not assuming that he was the shooter. I'm simply saying that what the facts were, as the officer knew them, everything the officer knew at that moment and observed at that moment provided the low level of suspicion, which was more than a hunch, and it was specific articulable facts with some quantum of individualized suspicion. I know I'm repeating that, but those are the crux here that is, you know, that really matters, and these are obviously very fact-specific cases, and there have been many unpublished cases applying these applying reasonable suspicion analysis to shot spotters. There are plenty of cases around the country. This technology is used in at least 100 cities, and there are various issues that come up. But on the reasonable suspicion analysis, that's not really where the shot spotter stuff is as problematic, because it is a machine. It is like a burglar alarm or one of those kinds of alarms that says glass shattered in this building, and it alerts the police to come. Something is amiss. Something is wrong.
In that respect, it's even better than a tip, right? Because somebody might be reporting something to the police with different motivations than actually reporting a suspected crime.
Yes, that is significant in the state. It's the state's position that it is much better than an anonymous tip for that reason, that you don't have the maybe malicious intentions or the other motivations that you have with especially an anonymous tip. But the key thing is that it gives an address. So, you know, as opposed to a caller who says, I've just heard shots fired and my address is this.
But counsel gives no description.
Well, if, no.
Right?
So and the state hasn't ever said anything
right,
otherwise.
Right, but you know the shots are fired. And so, like, I did read many of the other cases in the other District of Columbia. Has a few cases, one of which just came out a couple of weeks ago, and the Seventh Circuit case. But in those cases, even the shot spotter, they talk about some other corroboration. So it's not just officers responding to shot spotter. It's officers either hearing it themselves and having shot spotter, or someone calls and having shot spotter, or multiple shot spotter. Is there anything to the fact that those cases involve corroboration, and here we just all we have is shot spotter, and then we know that the technology is supposed to tell you that within 80 feet of the place they say the shots were fired, that that's where the shots were fired. I mean, should corroboration be part of this?
I think if we're talking about the same Seventh Circuit case, I mean, in that case, there did happen to be 911 calls that came on. There is a footnote there, and of course, when I found the Seventh Circuit case, I was like, woohoo, this is perfect. And it is, no, it's got, but then they have that 911 call that we don't have. So, okay, that works.
But it's not just that they just happen to. They rely on it. I'm looking at paragraph 10. First, and as Rickman concedes, Officer Ella Fritz received 2 ShotSpotter alerts and 2 dispatches reporting a shooting. And then it gives the details. And they say, we agree that ShotSpotter is not comparable to eyewitness information, but, you know, here, corroboration from multiple sources describing the general area and nature of the same crime exceeds the single police tip that alone can supply reasonable suspicion. So, I mean, there was some corroboration in these other cases.
There was. I think there are, I mean, the footnote that I noted in the, this is U.S. v. Rickman, it's 950F3rd876.
Right, that's what I was reading.
I thought it sounded familiar. In footnote 2, the court says, you know, the defendant here didn't challenge ShotSpotter's adequacy. We take his argument, therefore, as based on reasonable suspicion and don't need to reach the reliability of ShotSpotter in reliability where a single alert turns out to be the only articulable fact in the totality of the circumstances. And it cites a case in Nebraska that said that was sufficient, that the technology was reliable.
There's no challenge to the reliability of ShotSpotter in this case either, is there?
Correct.
And since we're talking about Rickman case, I have a follow-up question. The Seventh Circuit there said there was reasonable suspicion, and the officer encountered the vehicle on the same block of the shooting 5.5 minutes after he received reports of shots fired. I think there could have been a lot of activity between the time the shots were fired in the ensuing 5 minutes. I'm not calling into question the Seventh Circuit's determination, but I think it informs this court's ruling because here we're talking about less than a minute.
Well, the similarity I seized on in the Rickman case was that was the only car on the street at the time the officers came. I tried to figure out whether I thought it mattered that it was a person in a car versus a person on foot. And that's not my case, so I don't have to. But I don't, you know, I think the Seventh Circuit analysis shows that that might not be a deal breaker for a reasonable suspicion analysis.
Ms. Bice, I want to ask you a question about the term bleeding.
And yes.
I'd like to ask you to respond to State v. Pugh, and I'm just going to read one sentence, actually 2 sentences from paragraph 13. And in that case, the court is talking about bleeding, and they say, but how does a person walk away from another, as Pugh has the right to do, without turning his or her body to some degree, calling a movement that would accompany any walking away, bleeding, is in quotation marks, adds nothing to the calculus except a false patina of objectivity. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think that's the money quote in Pugh. I mean, that's the hard language, and I recognize that. The, you know, I think that the circumstances of Pugh, these are totality. And Pugh was like walking near a drug house. There was not a, you know, there wasn't a, the circumstances that that occurred in were not a respond to a shots fired, 4 shots fired and see who's there. I mean, I think that the language from Rudzinski, and I will answer the blading, I mean, I think that there was more than just turning away in this case. He was reaching, digging, the officer testified, digging on his left side, trying to conceal one side of his body. And that was more than what was described in Pugh. But if it's not, if you don't accept that answer for the blading in this case, Rudzinski said, where the allegations in the tip suggest an imminent threat to public safety or other exigency that warrants immediate police investigation, the Fourth Amendment doesn't require police to idly stand by in hopes their observations reveal behavior before the imminent threat comes to its fruition. That's more of this, the context of this analysis of this case.
That's kind of what struck out to me about the Court of Appeals opinion. But for one case, the Court of Appeals relied on a lot of cases that did not involve shots fired, much less shots by a shot spotter. And the imminent danger factor, when we're looking at the totality of circumstances that is presented by a report of shots, I think is one of the more compelling factors in this case, aside from the fact that within 1 minute, Nimmer was the only person in the vicinity of the shots fired in this case, right?
I found the Court of Appeals decision a little frustrating because the cases that it relied on, as you said, most of them didn't involve shots fired. There is the Lewis case, which was an unpublished misdemeanor case, which wouldn't affect the reasonable suspicion analysis, of course. But the other, Washington, was a loitering case. And so after dealing with, like, the loitering case and using the language from the loitering case, where the police said that they were going to charge him with loitering, I'm at paragraph 23 of the Court of Appeals opinion. And then it's, you know, on paragraph 25, from Washington, we take away the principle that when officers are investigating a specific crime, the mere presence of an individual in the area where that crime is suspected of having been committed isn't sufficient. But that just seemed to me to wash away all of the context of this case and treat this like a loitering case where, well, the guy was standing there. That means that the fact that he was there can't be taken into account. And I don't think that's legit. The reasonable suspicion standard doesn't translate across different kinds of crimes very well, because the crime that's being investigated matters to the analysis.
Do you think the Court of Appeals decision looks at each factor in isolation that's presented under the totality of the circumstances rather than taking them together?
Well, yes, that nails it pretty much. I think that that is the kind of divide and conquer reasonable suspicion analysis that this court has rejected and the Supreme Court has rejected. It is true that you can't add up a bunch of small, you know, things that don't, you can't just add up things. We get that. But when you take each piece and then say, well, here's a case that had that kind of behavior in it, and that wasn't enough. And here's a case, I mean, that's what they did when they said the common denominator in these cases was that there was no reasonable suspicion found. Well, yeah, those cases didn't involve shots fired, and the guy found right there on the spot. I mean, the question, the other thing is that in their, in paragraph 28, it sort of dismisses the, you know, the conduct of Nimmer when the police saw him, and we know that that can be taken into effect analysis, that he accelerated his walking pace. I believe the testimony is he doubled his pace. In other words, it was a significant noticeable speed difference upon seeing the squad. He didn't break into a run. That's true. But the court said, well, increasing his walking pace doesn't mean fleeing the scene, and, you know, this is comparable to a mere hunch. I don't think that that a fair analysis of this is, it characterizes this stop as based on a mere hunch.
Is there anything in the trial court record to suggest that the circuit court judge called into question the veracity of any statements made by the police or any testimony of the police?
No, the credibility determinations were, and I that's at page 35 and 36 is where, I mean, it's really a very simple transcript to a simple, straightforward case and a simple transcript. The court made clear that that its findings I'm sorry, I was trying to find the line where it made the determination of credibility of the officers. But there was one point in dispute. Nimmer testified and said that he was not walking away faster. He did not speed up. And the court said, as to that point, I find the officer more credible. I find that he did, I'm finding, based on the testimony, he accelerated his pace of walking in response to learning that the police were near him.
The reason I was asking you that is because I was a bit puzzled by a line from the Court of Appeals opinion in paragraph 26, and I'm going to shorten it and paraphrase slightly. We cannot help but wonder whether in response to these decisions, the decisions on which the Court of Appeals relied, which largely, again, didn't involve shots fired or much less shots fired, whether in response to these decisions, officers have sought to find magic language for their articulated facts to describe a person's behavior. But I didn't see anything in the record to suggest that the police were using some kind of magic words rather than testifying as to what they actually saw on the street that night.
There wasn't any, aside from just the challenges Nimmer's account made, there wasn't anything that questioned the officer's account. And I mean, there are cases, and I found one that was, they don't normally come up. When the state loses these, there's not a lot of record of them. But in a civil case where a person who had been stopped was then, and the Judge Semple in Milwaukee County found no reasonable suspicion. He watched the body cam. It was in response to a shot spotter. He watched the body cam, and the officers said, well, we saw him, like, turn away, and he was walking suspiciously. I mean, body cams sort of address that. I mean, the officers can see it. And so the state loses in those cases. The judge said, no, there wasn't any individualized suspicion here. You had the shot spotter. That's not enough. I think my light's on, but I'm not sure.
It is.
I'm so sorry.
I don't know why the red light's not showing today, but the red light is not showing today. It just goes off, which is why I keep looking over Tammy every time we're in this situation.
So okay.
Thought it might have been a glitch in the first oral argument, but thank you very much. Mr. Rosen.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. We clearly have the position that the Court of Appeals correctly overturned Judge Yamahiro's decision. I think not only for the issue about his statement that anybody in the area should have been stopped at that time, which I think clearly the state has acknowledged was wrong, but also because of the facts that were present at the time, to include this shot spotter technology, does not support the individualized, particularized suspicion that is required under such a situation, even under a totality of the circumstances standard. The one thing that struck me about this case is that even though my client may have been close, I mean, there was some testimony, it was South End, there was a yard sort of language, but the Google Maps that the state itself cited in its reply brief, which I looked up and printed, showed that this was just an extremely highly residential area. We're not talking about an open field here where there's a person out by himself, no place to hide. This was in the middle of a number of houses. I have the picture right here. And that, as Judge Karofsky clearly indicated, somebody could have fired in the air, fired from a backyard, fired, and then just run into our house. And there's really no reason to believe that that's not what happened. So I think when the state presented this photo, I think it does show that my client was relatively close to where the shot spotter pointed out. But the fact of the matter is, I was just amazed. It's an inner city Milwaukee area, which I think is clearly just laden with residential buildings, duplexes just next to each other, boom, 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 right next to each other.
Doesn't that heighten the exigency for the police to stop somebody if they have reasonable suspicion, which the state is arguing they had under the totality of circumstances, given that it's a residential area where the shots were fired and not an open field?
Well, I think you still have to have the individualized suspicion that my client was the one who was the shooter. I think, as I think the case law says that we've got here, I think State versus Gordon clearly indicated, you can't just say, well, you have a high crime area, and that sort of throws the rules out the window.
Well, right, and you can't stop every single person who's on the street, but he was the only one, and it was less than a minute after the shots were fired, and given his movements as described in the police's testimony, why isn't that enough to meet the very low bar that reasonable suspicion has?
Well, I think as the court said and as the courts have said, there was no corroboration. I think the state cited State versus Anderson. I think the Seventh Circuit court case that you have cited, that Judge Dowd referred to, you need some corroboration.
Corroboration of what, though? A 911 call corroborates the shot, but you're not challenging the reliability of ShotSpotter, are you?
No, and I think that we are not. But the thing is, I think it's pretty clear about ShotSpotter technology, is I think it can say when and where. I think now it's gotten to the point where it can say what. It can distinguish between firecrackers. I think that's pretty clear. I'm not disputing that. But what it cannot say is who. And I think that's one thing, like, when you have, like, and I think, with all due respect to Your Honor, I think when you do have a reliable tip that's corroborated, is I think required under Alabama versus Williams, you need to have some corroboration that this person is telling the truth, that they say, I saw somebody do this and this, and then that becomes a corroboration. As this court had said in State versus Anderson, that, as I indicated, petitioner had cited in his briefs, that was based upon, their reasonable suspicion was based upon the fact that people, there had been complaints that this guy, Anderson, had been a drug dealer. There is nothing like that in the record here. What we have is my client, and I know my client allegedly, according to the testimony from the cops, Malone said that he sort of sped up his pace, but it was pretty clear from the record during cross-examination that he admitted that my client did not flee, that my client went away. I turned around and sort of walked a little faster. It was late at night. I think he was in police. I think there's a case that said that when you have police, it gets a nervous tension going on. And then you've got the issue with the security adjustment where there's a couple of cases. I think Gordon is the one that said, even if you sort of fixed looking for a wallet, that's not enough. You've got the Pew standard, which says, blading is something that's not uncommon. You've got to turn your body. And I think the Court of Appeals did a lengthy decision in this case analyzing all that. I don't believe that they did any sort of, piecemeal picking out of saying this is not enough, this is not enough, this is not enough. I do believe, from what I recollection of the record, is that they comprise it, said even you've got all of this stuff here together, including the ShotSpotter technology, that's not enough.
But the only shots fired case that the Court of Appeals relied on was Lewis. And in Lewis, we don't know how long it took for the officers to arrive at the scene, right? That did not factor into the analysis. In this case, we know the officers arrived less than a minute after the shots were fired, and the only person they saw was your client.
Correct. And like I think Justice Karofsky made a good point that if my client had been the shooter, he would have run. He would have been gone within that
but
minute.
But that's speculation. We don't know why.
No, it is.
Do what
but
they
I
do.
Think it goes to the issue of the reasonable individualized suspicion in terms of the state's burden of proof. I agree, Justice Bradley, that is speculation. But I think it goes to the issue of the whole residential area thing, that just because my client is walking on the street on a highly residential area 60 seconds after some shots have been fired in that area does not give the police the right to say, all right, we're going to stop you.
Don't you think that the cases around the country that have evaluated ShotSpotter circumstances like this all cut against your argument?
Well, I, with all due respect, I was looking at the Wisconsin law, and I think that I did have the Lewis case, and I think it's clearly an issue of the totality of the circumstances, that's just one piece of the puzzle that goes in there. And I think, as Justice Dallas said with the Seventh Circuit case that just came out a few weeks ago, there's corroboration. You have people pointing the finger saying this is corroboration.
Well, there was no corroboration of people saying that's the guy, go get him. That's not in that case. But if we just look at the Wisconsin law, we do have one case, Tally Claiborne. It's unpublished from 2017. You cite it and discuss it. I'm not sure how to distinguish that from these circumstances. There, the Court of Appeals said there was reasonable suspicion under the totality of the circumstances. They heard gunshots. They got on the scene almost immediately, just like in this case. They saw three individuals, and Tally Claiborne made furtive movements. That was enough for the Court of Appeals then.
Well, my recollection of that case, and this was the case that the state cited, is I had distinguished that in my brief, and my recollection was that case was what had happened was the police had taken these three individuals, lined them up, and while they started looking at this guy over here, checking him out, Tally Claiborne starts walking away right while they've got him lined up, and that clearly pointed out, hey, you know what, there's something going on here when we are... He knows what we're here for. He knows what we're doing. He knows we're checking people out, and yet he's making an attempt. And he refused, from my recollection, Tally Claiborne, the guy refused to come back after being told, hey, get back here, which I think is clearly a red flag. I think that case is distinguishable from this situation, with all due respect, Your Honor. I do think that, and I think I argued that in my brief, that is not applicable. I think when you look at the Lewis case, I know it's an unpublished case. Now, one thing I do know, what did strike me about all these Court of Appeals cases, even though if they went in front of, ruled in favor of the defendant, is for some reason, I don't know, if the state never sought to seek petition for Supreme Court review in those cases, or if it was just denied, but the Supreme Court never sort of stepped in and said, we're going to look at that and say, what's going on here with these cases that have, you know, come down in favor of this defendant. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what happened in those cases. I just checked out to see if there was some cite to a petition for Supreme Court review denied. I didn't see that, so I don't know what happened with that. But that's just kind of what's going on with those cases. I mean, I've got the cases where in Lewis there was the shooting, you know, there was a shot spotter. They turned around and they said, that's not enough, I think. And then you've got as the state cited right now, they had the Washington case, which was a loitering case. But what the thing about that case was that was right in front of a residence or a building, a vacant building, that had been a known site for drug dealing. That was a place where the Court of Appeals said that even by that, being right there where the crime is, a crime area, is not sufficient. So I think that case is distinguishable here in this present situation.
So what should law enforcement have done here? They know shots are fired. They just go make sure no one needs medical attention and head out?
Well, I don't know. I suppose they did their job. They looked around. I still think that the issue is what they should have done was decide, you know, there needs to be an objective. This court does a de novo review of this sort of Fourth Amendment in terms of whether or not there's an individualized suspicion that verifies what the police did. So I cannot say what the police officers should have done. Maybe they would have come up there and found two people arguing, somebody with a gun. Maybe they could have found, you know, a raucous party where people are, you know, somebody's firing an air. Maybe they could have found something a lot more inculpatory that would have objectively required their attention, you know, people outside smoking marijuana.
But they're supposed to just not do any investigation and shots are fired. I mean, we talk about this being a high crime area. It's predominantly residential. Should there be no concern for the people who live in these areas and are subjected to this type of gunfire in these high crime areas?
Oh, no. I think that the police came about. They did the right thing. They came around. But there still needs to be the reasonable individualized suspicion that the person is...
Hold on a second. Do you have to have individualized suspicion to ask somebody on the street, hey, did you see anything?
But no, you can ask people. I think as Florida versus Royer said, you can ask people, but they don't have to, you can't detain them unless you have some reasonable individualized suspicion under Terry. And that's the distinction here is people can be, you know, hey, can we ask you a question? Sure. But if you're going to say, we're going to stop you, we're going to, that's a totally different world, as the U.S. Supreme Court, as I said, under Florida versus Royer said. It's apples and oranges. So I think just because somebody's walking down the street at night in a highly residential area, 60 seconds, it was a minute. I'll be honest with the court. I think 60 seconds is not a short time. I think it's a fairly significant amount of time for perpetrators, lawbreakers to run, to go away, to go high. They could run down the block. They could run away. They could run around the corner if they take off. 60 seconds is not a short period of time.
Was the Seventh Circuit wrong in Rickman? There it was 5.5 minutes after the shot fired that they stopped him.
I cannot say if they got wrong. I cannot say that, Your Honor. I'm just here to talk about what we have in this case, that I think the 60 seconds isn't there. I mean, if the police had come by, right, you know, boom, boom, you're there, they might have seen something much more inculpatory on my client's part. Maybe, maybe not, but they didn't. And that's the problem with this case from the state's perspective, is they didn't see enough, there wasn't enough there, as the Court of Appeals said, to show that my client had the individualized suspicion required, that is required under the law, under clearly Terry and every case that's out of here and every other jurisdiction that I know of in the United States of America.
Are you familiar with United States v. Jones? It's a case that came down this year from the D.C. Circuit.
No, I'm not. Around.
Okay, that's a shot spotter case. I'm not going to ask you too much about it, but the facts here I found compelling because they're so similar to the facts we have in this case. Police arrived a minute and a half after the shot spotter alert. They saw Jones walking quickly. No one else was on the block. They stopped him, found a handgun, and the court said the officers had reasonable suspicion. An important factor was Jones's, quote, presence in the precise area where a crime had recently occurred. And the court emphasized that, of course, officers do not need to rule out all innocent possibilities or explanations before making a stop. There was also evasive conduct in this case.
Your Honor, I cannot respond to that one way or the other. All I can respond is the case that both the state and I have argued and what I've briefly heard about the Seventh Circuit case that came out recently. And I think based upon what we've got here, once again, as I said, the shot spotter cannot say who. In the area, I don't think is, for this case, as I said, I think is almost works against the state because of the fact that it was such a highly residential area. And as we've talked about, it's not a high crime area. It's not something that you're going to use against the individual. I think the case law is there. I think as far as the spent cartridge that was found, allegedly, I don't know. And once again, I don't. That's putting the cart before the horse. I think that's, and I think the state's conceded that is not an issue that's relevant for individualized suspicion.
Counsel, one of the elements here relied upon by the state is that the defendant bladed his body. I just wonder how many times in my life, when I thought I was just turning away from someone, I was blading. I have no idea. What's the difference, if you could explain to me, between turning away from and blading?
Well, I think as the Court of Appeals correctly pointed, it's almost the same thing, that's what's going to happen. When you turn your body, you are the police call it blading. And I think that's maybe where this issue came about in our decision, in our case, where the Court of Appeals talked about magic words.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. But there must be something, and I don't understand it. You know, decades ago, the word blade, this is for the students that are here, to show how words, the meanings change. Decades ago, the word blade meant a dapper young fellow. And so I'm perplexed by what blading means here, why it's so important, because I just don't understand the distinction.
Well, I think that's what the Court of Appeals in this case and, it, as I said, in Pew found important, is that, you know, you put a word on something and, it, you know, oh, it's inculpatory, and you put it, you know, just call it what it is, and it's not. You throw these magic words out there, and all of a sudden, next thing you know, well, you know, there's all sorts of problems. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals and here sort of said. It's just because somebody's turning their body away to start walking away. It's a normal reaction. You turn your body away, and you start walking away. Well, all of a sudden now, you know, law enforcement is saying, well, that's reasonable suspicion. He's doing something naughty.
I might be asking the impossible. Your response is not a surprise. So what's your understanding of the other side's argument that blading is something different than turning their body? What's your understanding of that?
I think their position, the state's position, is that when somebody blades, they're hiding something.
I want to know physically what happens. I mean, you know, what?
I think it's, you know, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder. I think, as the Court of Appeals said, when you turn your body away, it could be a normal reaction, just walking away. The state, you know, clearly wants to say that, oh, it means you're hiding something and you've got something that
we need
to...
That's the motivation. I'm talking about the mechanics of it. If you're able to answer, there must be something different.
I don't know. I think, you know, when I walk and I, you know, pretend I'm bleeding and see if that's something that might,
I'd like,
you know,
to see that, but anyway.
That might,
no,
you know,
further questions. Thank you.
But counsel, to follow up on that line of questioning, the state is not arguing, are they, that blading was in and of itself sufficient for Terry's stop here? There was a lot more to the totality of the circumstances. I mean, I can read the state's argument, although I'm sure Ms. Bice will respond to that on rebuttal, but compellingly here, the police received a ShotSpotter report. They responded immediately. They were just a block or so away. They saw your client. He was the only one walking, and he reacted to the police, according to the police, by walking quickly away, holding his left waistband, and turning his left side away from the police. That's my understanding of blading. But yes, it has different contexts, different meanings. Professional wrestling, it means something altogether different that I won't get into here. But it's not the blading, right? It's all these other facts, looking
Correct.
At it in totality.
And I think that's what it was. Now, I think the Court of Appeals in this case did analyze that. I think the state is wrong saying that they piecemeal this thing out. But the Court of Appeals, from my recollection of reading the opinion that they had in this case, did apply a totality of the circumstances. They said, you know, not just individually blading, not just individually doing a security adjustment, not just the ShotSpotter, they said, all told, you put everything in a pot, mix it all up, and you still don't have enough.
And I read the Court of Appeals opinion a little differently because I saw them go through each of the factors and say, nope, that's not enough. No, that's not enough. And then they make this conclusory statement that, putting it all together even. So, you know, there wasn't much there to explain why putting it all together does not amount to reasonable suspicion.
I thought, well, maybe I read it wrong. I thought, therefore, this is paragraph 30, therefore we conclude that, even taken together, these facts, all the facts that you've discussed, do not support a finding that the officers had a reasonable suspicion to stop and frisk Nimmer. That's paragraph 30.
Right, so, and that's why I'm saying it's conclusory, because the analysis goes through each of the factors individually and says, nope, not enough. And then they make this statement at the end, which, you know, they're calling what the police does magic words. To me, this is magic words.
Well, I just read that sentence, and to me that pertains that I think the three judges that were on this court that did this were said in the totality, even everything taken together, added up all together, is still not enough. And that's kind of, whether it's conclusion or not, I think they looked at each piece and they said, we still don't have enough here, taking everything together. And that's, they didn't explain everything further, but that's just what they said, is it even total, it's not enough. So I think that's what they said. And I think that they said that. And I think the state is wrong on that. Well, I don't have anything further. If there's any more questions, I'm
Any other to... questions from the bench? All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal?
Thank you. We'll answer that. Let's say what it is in real words and not use blading. I went back to the transcript, and it's at pages 7 through 9, I think, the officer was talking and says, when he got there, I observed one subject who was at the southeast corner of the intersection, basically the exact location where the shot spotter came in. I did not observe anybody else. So then when he's asked, what did you do when you saw this person? I observed he had his right hand in his right pants pocket. The subject then turned and looked at our squad. He then immediately looked away and began accelerating. And I stepped out of the squad, I'm skimming past, and approached. As I was approaching behind him, he began turning his left side away from me. So at that point, his left side was more forward, and I could only really see his right side. I could observe his left arm was still digging around. I was directly behind him on the sidewalk, and his right hand was within view, but his left hand was not. And what did that indicate to you? It indicated to me that he did not want me to be able to see his left side. That is, I think, what we're really talking about, and I don't like magic words and obfuscatory words or whatever that is. I would like to call it what it is. The court then said, also, obviously, the testimony with regard to blading is consistent with somebody who's trying to conceal a weapon. So it's hiding something. And
And by the way, what was in the left side of this person's?
A 40 caliber gun, Smith & Wesson, I think.
And what was this person charged with? Was the person charged with
felon
discharging
in possession?
A
no,
firearm?
He was not charged with discharging a weapon. He was charged with felon in possession. He had a prior felony, and so that was the charge. The as to the comment briefly of that, you know, Lewis wasn't petitioned for review. That was a misdemeanor case. Probably our office at DOJ weren't even aware of that. That those are misdemeanor appeals are handled by the DA in that case, and we did not pursue the Lewis. Well, in fact, Lewis, we conceded error, so that wouldn't have been a thing we would have appealed. So disregard that.
How about your math? Zero plus zero plus zero equals what? Paragraph 30, as your opposing counsel indicates, the court said something like, taken all together. And, of course, all of the together stuff was all zero.
I do recognize that I've used that often in my own
That's why
drafting.
I,
zero that's, plus zero equals zero. You can't line up. Well, he had on Timberland shoes, and those are commonly worn by gang members, and he had on baggy jeans, and you can't add up things that don't matter. So I don't think this is a zero plus zero, but whatever has to add up, it doesn't have to add up to very much. Terry anticipates innocent people are going to be stopped. That, you know, getting...
Right, but isn't the concern, Attorney Bice, that where are ShotSpotters set up? It's only set up in certain neighborhoods. And isn't it true this guy actually lived at this house where the shots were, near where the shots were fired? So, while you can say in general that innocent people might be stopped, we're really talking about innocent people that live in high-crime areas that may only be people who can't afford to live other than in high-crime areas, right?
Yes. I think that's one of the
does the record reflect where shot spotters are set up? That's the only thing that I'm trying to get at in this record. I don't remember seeing that.
Whether it tells where the shot spotter sensors are?
Right. Are
the record does not reflect where the shot spotter sensors are in this case. The concern about the shots fired stuff is that, the problem with getting officers to respond to shots fired in neighborhoods that are plagued by a lot of gun violence is getting them to the right spot quickly. And the complaint of residents is when we call, there's not a fast response, and this does address that. I I'm not sure if that answers your question, Justice Daly.
Well, it's okay. I don't know if there was a good answer to my question anyway. Attorney Bice.
I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. The court will adjourn. We will meet in closed at 1:30 to discuss matters. Any students who wish to stay on and hear the wisdom of Justice Karofsky, they're welcome to do so. She'll be back out shortly. Other than that, thank you for visiting with us today, and thank you, counsel, for your good argument. Court's adjourned.
Argument. Good kind of.